Self-care is a topic that comes up regularly in activist communities, and one that is acknowledged as essential when it comes to our mental health. But what it is, specifically, and how to administer it, isn't always so clear or easy. While it's a topic that many people I've spoken with have touched on, I felt it was essential to dedicate an entire episode to the subject. Today's collaborator, to discuss the importance of self-care, is Jennifer Harkness. As a licensed mental health counselor and registered art therapist specializing in anxiety and trauma, she has a great deal of experience with self-care both professionally and personally. Whether it's the burnout of compassion fatigue or the overwhelm of vicarious trauma, she offers great insight and guidance for self-care. Her simplest instruction, that a little is a lot, is about taking time to notice and meet the needs of our bodies. Stay hydrated, get a good night's sleep, and eat well. And she goes on to explain how this applies even when it comes to being of service. Just because we can't solve all the world's problems doesn't mean that the littlest thing we do isn't worth doing. Learning to change our perception, to understand the value of even the smallest act of kindness, is also self-care.
Hi, Jen. Thank you so much for collaborating with me on an episode.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I really, really appreciate it. So my starting question now that I've started to ask people is, if you could tell me a bit about when you were growing up and the point at which you sort of made a move from I am suffering into there is suffering. So that point when you made a move into like being an agent for change, being an activist in some way.
Oh boy. Well, that's a hard one. I think, I think for, you know, I'm a therapist and I always say we don't become therapists on accident. And so I grew up in a family system with addictions and trauma. And so I think I was in my own suffering very early and started caretaking my family and realizing that their suffering was impacting mine and vice versa. And so kind of came by it honestly at a very young age. And I find that to be a common theme for many people, especially in mental health, but many different caretaking fields, right? Where they come through to their compassion and caretaking through difficult experiences at young ages. So I'd say that's probably in short my answer to that.
That's very short. I'm really impressed. So you're on the show today because we're going to talk about self-care and you're an expert in this. And like you actually use this professionally. Most of my guests have talked about it to some degree because it becomes a really obvious thing that it is essential to this kind of work. And I think as soon as anyone steps into the role of caring for the world in a much bigger way, it's really, really obvious. Mm-hmm. But what self-care is, I think, isn't always really clear. So could you start by defining self-care and then the difference between self-care and self-indulgence?
Right, exactly. Which is where a lot of people will confuse the two and be, it's kind of like self-compassion. They'll be like, you know, I think I'm being self-centered or I'm selfish if I take care of myself. And I think that's one of the big myths about self-compassion and self-care. And I think it's a big definition. I think self-care is about how we care for ourselves in many different domains. I always start with the basics first. Like self-care is like taking care of your body, right? A lot of times people will be like, oh, you know, my self-care is I'm going to take this vacation or I'm going to get this massage. And I'm all for vacations and massages. But really, it's that chop wood, carry water, just the basic stuff you do day in and day out. Like, are you getting enough water? Are you eating? Are you sleeping? Those very basic things are part of self-care. And what I try to emphasize when I talk to people about this is it is that day-to-day stuff that you do that makes the biggest impact for self-care. And then you kind of go out from there, like your body, right? But then it's also about your worldview and your identity and, you know, how you regulate your emotions and your nervous system, your friends and family, how you have boundaries, right? Boundaries are a huge part of self-care, right? Both like boundaries internally, like how I take on issues, whether I take them personal or not, to boundaries of like, you know, yes or no, I have time to do this, right? And so within all of those categories, everybody's got their edge. Everybody's got the stuff that they're like, yeah, you know, I'm pretty good at saying no to overextending myself, but I'm not so great at, like, I tend to feel responsible for everybody's feelings and responsible for all the ills of the world and that sort of thing. So it's a big topic, and that's where I tell people too, you don't want self-care to become like another job. You know what I mean? Like, where it's like, it's overwhelming. 'Cause a lot of times when people come to self-care, they're already kind of burnt out, or they're noticing symptoms of compassion fatigue or vicarious trauma or burnout. And so it's like, a lot of times it's like, you got to start at that basic level of, how's your sleep? How are you hydrating? How are you eating? That sort of stuff.
It's not so much the big things, but the accumulation of the little things.
Mm-hmm.
And how those add up. I was just thinking about what you're saying about saying no and learning how to say no. And that mm-hmm. being a really big thing in activist communities, where you will see people who take the leadership role so much. And I used to do that. I was really bad at saying no. And I was recently in a Radical Dharma webinar, online webinar, and about self-care. And Angel Kyoto Williams said, when you say no to something, you need to learn that when you're saying no to one thing, you're actually saying yes to something else.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so, like, that's what it is, right? Understanding that no isn't saying, absolutely, I can't do this thing. It's actually might be saying, I need to put my energy elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a big part of self-care is the moment-to-moment noticing of how you're responding to the world, right? And that's where I kind of drop those terms like vicarious trauma and compassion fatigue and burnout. And the flip side to self-care is you have to know what those things are and the symptoms of them to recognize them, of like, I'm starting to go into an area that isn't healthy for me and I need to course correct, right? So, you know, we throw out self-care and burnout a lot when helping professions. And I kind of want to offer just quick definitions of those too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you know? Do that.
So compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma oftentimes get used interchangeably, but really when they very first were defined back in the 90s, they were separate things. And compassion fatigue was basically like a secondary post-traumatic stress disorder. It's like you're having the symptoms of PTSD through direct service. So a lot of like firefighters, nurses, therapists that were like witnessing or being reported firsthand accounts, you know, they were having symptoms of trauma, even though the trauma hadn't happened to them. So mm-hmm. that's kind of compassion fatigue. And vicarious trauma is more what happens over time. It's an accumulative effect of being around trauma. So that impacts, you know, again, your worldview, your spirituality, your identity, self-capacities, your work, your body, and again, your kind of your ego resources. You start to get pessimistic and hopelessness going on, meaninglessness. It's oftentimes looks like an existential crisis. And what that can lead to is burnout, which is like, I absolutely can't do this anymore. And direct service, right? That's kind of obvious why that kind of happens. But what I'm also seeing, especially like in the political climate of the last year, it's been a very interesting year with the current administration and all of the social justice issues coming up and being highlighted from that, you know, is that there's also like a collective trauma going on mm-hmm. and a collective anxiety. And, you know, when you are really paying attention to the world today, there's a lot. It's almost like, what issue do you pick, right? You're like, okay, like, there's plastic in the oceans and the animals are dying and Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ rights and just the union can go on, women's rights, on and on and on of all these things. And it can get really overwhelming. And I think that that's a kind of trauma that's happening where it's leading people actually to have these bigger, almost like vicarious trauma, like symptoms to witnessing or being a social activist within that, that's burning them out and then making them ultimately less effective. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It actually makes me think about, I've been noticing more and more a differentiation between the definition of empathy versus compassion, in that empathy is now being more defined as your ability to relate with from your own side. And from a place of empathy, we can enter into that overwhelm very easily because mm-hmm. of how we take on the pain and the suffering. And from a place of compassion, it's more of being able to relate to someone from their own side. So not necessarily even having had the experience, being able to just sort of relate on the basis that, you know, human suffering is there and we all have experience of it. And compassion being then more all-encompassing in a way that like you don't lose yourself in it. Mm-hmm. But it's like, that's hard, right? Like to relate to people from a place of genuine compassion, it's something that you have to train in a lot over time. And mm-hmm. when we're talking about self-care in so many ways, we are talking about compassion. We're talking about the ability to relate with ourselves as much as with others and see mm-hmm. the fullness of an experience and how to bear with whatever is going on, right? Like it's, to me, I see the difference of like empathy is like I can relate to, and compassion is I can relate to and bear with it without sort of losing myself. So I within Buddhism, what you're describing when you're talking about what is it, vicarious trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Vicarious trauma. That to me, it sounds like it's that near enemy of compassion, mm-hmm. which is the overwhelm, right? Like,
yeah,
there's just so much. So what are the techniques and tools and things that you use and that you advise people when they come to you with this for learning how to bear witness to suffering without mm-hmm. being overcome by it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're speaking to a lot of really key points in self-care. You know, again, where I start with people is a little is a lot. Are you hydrating? Like literally when I give talks, I'll be like, if you leave this with nothing else, like just check how much water you're drinking a day, like something tangible. Everything you just said is so true. But if a person's already starting to feel stressed and burn out, that's going to be overwhelming, right? Yeah. Just that right there. So it's like, start simple. But from there, what you really are talking about is differentiation. And the conversation I've been having a lot this year is not taking the suffering in the world personally. So you do have to figure out what larger container you're going to put it in. Because like if I, Jen Harkness, go out and I say like, okay, you know, I used to work in a Title I school and a lot of my kids were hungry. I'd mm-hmm. ask them what they're having for breakfast and they'd say like, my whole family shared a can of Coke, and like my heart would just break open. So then I kind of took it personally. I was like, I have to feed these people, you know? And it's like, you know, so I'd go out and I'd spend my meager earnings on food and I'd take it in, and that was helpful on one level. But what it started to do was it started to tap me, because I was thinking like somehow I was responsible for all these kids and them being hungry and all of that kind of stuff. And just psychologically, even it was starting to weigh me down. And this is something I hear a lot too, is that then I'd go home and I'd have dinner and I'd feel guilty, right? Mm. And I'd be like, oh, I've got heat and I've got food and I feel terrible that they're hungry. And ultimately it wasn't helping them or me. So I had to find a different way, which was that, you know, ultimately self-care, it's like I have to put the oxygen mask on me first. And that's not selfish. That's actually like, this isn't a sprint. This is a marathon. I deeply believe in helping people. Like service is the meaning I put in my life. And so I want to do this till I am really old. And yeah. So if I engage it like I was just explaining, right, that's just going to burn bright and hot and out really fast, right? And so the marathon is I need to frame it of like, I actually need to have a really good dinner and I need to have a warm place to sleep and I need to sleep well in order to go into the school the next day and bear witness and be with those children, right? Whether I can show up with granola bars or not, I'm mm-hmm. witnessing the suffering with them, right? And realizing that I'm not going to fix poverty. You know, like that's a really tall order. And so, but what I can do is even in those moments where I would sit with a kid, whether I had a snack or not, but I would validate their experience and I would be with them and we would maybe make art and they'd have a little respite while sitting with me in my therapy office for a little bit, a respite of like, you know, they felt safe and they knew they were cared for that moment. That's a lot, right? It's such a simple thing, but that's actually a lot. And so I think a lot of self-care too is how we are perceiving it, you know, how we're thinking mm-hmm. about it and working with that piece.
Yeah. Learning what's enough. What you're saying about you're not going to solve poverty. And I think that that's a really big part of the burnout quality is mm-hmm. that sense of I can't fix it all. So why even bother? And that there's this like hopelessness in that, which is an interesting one for me to look at because of having studied Pema Chodron and the way she talks about hope and how she says like, go in for hopelessness, because so much of the time, hope is about having an expectation about how something should be. So it's like the hope behind trying to alleviate poverty is I will completely eradicate it, which then when you can't achieve that, which you realize very quickly you can't, you just like spiral out versus taking an approach of equanimity, basically.
Absolutely. Well, and then I think also what tends to happen, you know, especially in the helping fields, nonprofit world, is there's like a poverty mentality that goes with that, right? So like, I'm trying to build a house out of toothpicks. You know, it's like the resources you have are so small, right? But you're like, okay, I got to do all this with these small resources. And so people are always like, give more, give more, give more, give more, right? In just like the system of helping, there's like this culture of feeding into the burnout of like, give more than you actually have. That's where the boundaries on both, and I'm talking about boundaries internally, but I'm also talking about being really clear about logistically what your boundaries are on your time, your energy levels. For me, like in the school, it was like, I didn't have a lot of money to buy granola bars, you know, it's not like I was getting paid a lot, you know, in nonprofits to be helping like that. So you have to be realistic on those edges and watch them. And you have to really be in tune with your body. So you say, you know, like, what are the tangible things? Part of it is mindfulness and being aware of the tension and fatigue in your body, right? Like I had one woman and I did a workshop on these topics. And when we were done, I was saying, you know, one of the things that happens with burnout is that people will get ill. You'll run yourself into illness, right? Eventually. And she said, wow, you know, I've been struggling with shingles on and off for years. And as soon as I heard your talk, I realized I've had no boundaries in my work and I have just been running myself into the ground and I kept wondering, why am I getting shingles? And now it's like, it's because I'm not taking care of my body because I'm giving it all to others. And I was like, it seems so basic, but again, you know, when you're in it, it's really easy to get carried away in it. That's where I think, it's not selfish to have self-care because, you know, when she had shingles, she was out of work for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. She's not available.
You can't really move or do anything.
Yeah. It's like, that's a pretty extreme example. And again, the system, many of these systems, if you work in them, there is a pressure to keep pushing. And so you have to be responsible for yourself in that and say, no, I'm not going to do that and go against that grain. And then there's pushback in that, which is challenging. So it's complicated.
We're also up against a society that values human worth based on your earning power and earning power at any expense kind of thing, right? At any cost, at the cost of the earth as it is, as it like a survivable place that we can all live and flourish in. And that's a big thing that comes through for people who specifically enter into any of the helping professions where they're hugely underpaid. And then on top of that, you have this societal assumption of like how much you deserve whatever you're getting paid.
Right.
And how difficult that is, because like a part of self-care is being able to pay the bills. Like you have to be able to do that to a certain degree. What about like wrestling sort of with that collective guilt that comes in? And I think also this is something that's really important in activist circles, the way we guilt and shame other people for not doing enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that comes from our own guilt and shame.
Yeah.
So this goes back to self-care. You know, you have to know yourself really well. And I don't know about you, but like when I'm running judgment and shame towards others, if I look really closely, I'm feeling like I'm not enough. And that's why I'm doing that. And it's also, so one of the big things in helping circles too is self-sacrificing. That's a bona fide. Yeah. It's like a style and it's perpetuated and there's many facets to self-sacrificing, but I think a lot of times it's because people want to feel good about themselves. Put almost like a narcissistic helping of like, I'm going to do this so I feel good about myself and I look good. Now, there is altruism feels good and it's an important thing and there is nothing wrong with feeling good about helping, right? Yeah. But if you're doing it to feed that part of your ego, that's going to be a recipe for burnout too. If you're doing it from a place of, I love myself, I care for myself, I am enough, and I want to help because it feels good, that's a very different energy than I am avoiding myself, I am feeding something in myself that feels unworthy, and I'm actually working out my issues through helping other people.
Yeah.
It's a very different vibe. So therapy, you know, self-care, do some therapy. I'm a bias, but, you know, I think it's or not even therapy, but self-reflection of some kind, right? I don't care what it is, but some kind of self-reflection on looking at what your intentions, motivations, your values, and your drives are to help is really important, actually.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about my own experience, my mom used to say that I had a tendency to bring home strays, as she would put it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I would give so much of myself to trying to basically to save people. And mm-hmm. to my own detriment, like, I would neglect my own needs. And then it was really terrible because, like, this person would be resentful because I couldn't fix them or because I was trying to fix them. And mm-hmm. then I was, like, disappointed because I'd put all of my sense of happiness on, like, whether or not someone else was okay or I'd solved a problem or something. Which is interesting, though, because my experience now, having done therapy
mm-hmm. yep.
and having a really solid Buddhist practice, is now interest of another person's well-being to me is as important as my own. Like, I don't see others' well-being as being less important than my own. However, I no longer see it as, like, they need to be okay in order for me to be okay. I'm like, I need to be okay in order for me to be beneficial.
Absolutely. That last statement is absolutely it right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was what you're saying about putting the mask on, right? If you can't breathe, you can't mm-hmm. help anyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then this is where I was really looking forward to this interview because I talk to you because I have a lot of therapists and helpers on my caseload. And so it's like, I don't care what larger container people seek or need. It could be going out and taking really long hikes, or it could be any kind of religion, or I don't care what it is, but you have to have a bigger container where you are not holding it all, but you're having other spaces and other worldviews to hold it. So Buddhism for me also really works, right? I can drop into that equanimity of, look, suffering's like a baseline. I don't have to, like, hold all the world's suffering. I can tap into bodhicitta and, like, do some Tonglin. And that's a container for me to put it into, to where I'm not running it through my personal system.
Yeah.
And for me, the practice of Tonglin has been crucial in my self-care. And, like, you know, a million times a day, I run into people will say something or do something. I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help. And I'm supposed to be the expert. They're coming to me for this help. And it's like, well, how do I drop into that bigger container and that bigger space, right, to be in the uncertainty with them? Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, that's when we can tap into the answers together. Again, mm-hmm. it's not even taking personally that I have all the answers, because that is pretty hubris anyway. It's more like, okay, I'm going to sit in this suffering and uncertainty with you, and we will collaborate on what this answer is for that person or for that situation.
That makes me think two things. One thing is Tonglin and possibly a brief canter through what that is, but thinking about that working with, and again, difference in the way that empathy is being defined these days versus compassion, and that compassion, that, like, sort of with someone and the impact that things have. I think thinking about therapy in particular, of how that relationship helps people find their own wisdom.
Yeah.
And that you can't help people find their own wisdom by telling them things.
Absolutely. And I feel deeply, and this is why I do interviews like this, that knowledge is power too. So mm-hmm. part of my job is to, you know, I research, I study, and I share that knowledge like I am with you right now. And then collaborating with that person on what they want to do with that knowledge. Because self-care, it's not a one size fits all, you know,
yeah.
And even in my own life, maybe one day a long hot shower is exactly what I need for self-care. And maybe the next day I need to work out vigorously. And maybe the next day it's something else. You see, it's like you have to have a big enough toolkit for yourself that you can sort and choose what you need. And that toolkit's going to look different for every single person. And so it's really it's catering to that. And I think there's a parallel in communities, right? Of like people going into community and saying like, this is what you need and what you should do. I don't think that's very helpful. I think it's more helpful to go in with this bigger container and, you know, wanting to be of support and saying, how can I be of support? You know, rather than because, and again, and this ties into burnout, because if I go in always thinking I have the answers, that will burn me out. I think wisdom is no, you don't have all the answers.
Yeah. Being a knower is really hard.
It is.
It's exhausting. It's a lot of pressure.
It is.
I was thinking about what you were saying about what kind of self-care is effective self-care and how that can change and how it's different for different people. And thinking about meditation as a practice and, mm-hmm. and when self-care can actually start, like when it shifts from not being self-care, something that you might be doing, because it's actually a head in the sand thing. Like it's actually a shutting down thing. Because I think like for me, my understanding of why you do this self-care is so that you can remain open, so that you can still be in those spaces. So you might need to retreat and you like consciously go, I am not going to go on Facebook for the weekend. I am going to go camping without my phone. Like I'm just going to completely disconnect, which is a sense of not like avoidance, but just being like, no, because I need to take a break from these things so I can center and connect in with myself and what's going on and feel some groundedness, versus like when you are using it to just check out.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, and this is where I'm so glad you brought that up, because self-care, look, there is a time and a place for distraction and checking out, right? Like some weekends I'm like, I need to do like an 8-hour Netflix binge and absolutely escape my life. And and it's that, if as long as you do that with intention, right? If I go into that and I say, I am like actually checking out on purpose, great. Let yourself check out. Enjoy it, right? That's very different than just like going on autopilot and Netflix binging for the weekend, right? And so a lot of it has to do with your awareness and your intention on what and why you're doing things. So there's a time and a place for distraction, but the best self-care, that day-to-day self-care, has more to do with checking in than checking out. It's not about getting away from the stress. It's about learning how to regulate the stress, cope with the stress, check in with the stress, and care for the stress. Let me give a couple of examples. Obviously, I'm like my longest term case study, you know, with myself. And so I use myself as an example. I see like maybe 7-8 clients in a day. Obviously, I'm deeply attending to other people for an hour. While I'm attending to them, I do little check-ins with myself and my body. How is my body feeling? And, you know, where am I tense? Do I need to adjust that? Where am I holding? Do I need to take a breath, right? Little things throughout the hour to bring me back to my experience too with them. Because if I put all my focus on them and I ignore myself, guess what happens by the end of the day? I'm really tense and I don't feel good. I used to get headaches all the time because I wasn't checking in, even just with my basic stuff like my posture. I sip tea all day, you know, to make sure that I'm hydrating. I have snacks in between sessions. One thing that I've done since I was an intern is I run to the bathroom, whether I have to go or not, in between each client. And what I do is I wash my hands and I intentionally think about like washing off that session so I can be clear for the next one. And I look at myself dead in the eye in the mirror and I give myself empathy and I name how I'm feeling, like, oh, Jen, you're tired, or wow, I'm excited, that was a good session, or wow, I'm really thinking about my friend who's having a hard time, or whatever it is. But I validate what my experience is, right, throughout the day, hour by hour, because I know that that's going to regulate my nervous system. It's going to keep me connected to myself. So again, that's the oxygen mask, so I can be available for the next person. And it's not going to just build up this stress and residue over time. It's kind of like cleaning house. I'm sweeping it out little by little throughout the day, rather than pushing through all week and then on the weekend crashing. That's that marathon thing. You got to learn what you need to do it day in and day out, right? And it needs to be tangible. There's these other pieces of like differentiation and insight, and that's important. But some of it's got to be really chop wood, carry water, tangible self-care, like ritual and routine that you do every day, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I know that ever since I created a routine for myself every morning, it's amazing how even on the hardest, going through like a really tough time, something might be really up, there's this sense of like, I have a container in a space that is just like, I know every morning, this is what will happen. Mm-hmm. And knowing that this is what will happen means that I have that space that I have deliberately created for myself every single day, no matter what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it needs to be, a sacred space, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I think we create these tangibly, and then over time, what starts to happen, I know now that I've been practicing meditation for, I don't know what, like 14 years or something like that now, and done 20 years of therapy, blah, 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 right? It's become like internalized to where, yeah, I can take a breath and I have a sacred space within myself that I have access to any moment. And that has been cultivated over time. And so if you want to talk about long game self-care, it's how do you cultivate that in yourself and how do you keep coming back to it? And when I say sacred space, I'm talking about that space that's not taking things personally, that has access to the bigger picture of I am one person in billions and I'm doing the best that I can. And that a sense of like, it's going to be okay. And I don't mean it's going to be okay, like the outcome's going to be what I want necessarily, but like, it's going to be okay that I can regulate myself and I can be present and I can love myself through just about anything. That's that self-compassion piece. Like I can be a good friend to myself. That's always there. It's always inside of me. And I deeply know how to emotionally, physically, mentally, and spiritually care for myself. That's what you cultivate over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that habituation to it. So like having some sort of formal practice, which then does bring me to Tonglen, which I didn't mm-hmm. forget.
Yes.
Because Tonglen as a formal practice, so giving and taking, mm-hmm. for me, and the very formal way it's taught of like breathing in something dark and heavy and whatever stress and stuff on the in-breath and then breathing out relief for that on the out-breath and that sense of like taking it in for others, the in-breath out-breath thing for me is like discombobulating and mm-hmm. and it's weird because I think that the big challenge that people have with Tonglen is like the idea of breathing in and taking on the painful aspects of life. But for me, I'm like, it's just the switch, it's just so fast for me, like but what I found mm-hmm. is like you do that formally, as discombobulating it is as it is, but it then comes up spontaneously, right? Like when you establish
Absolutely.
That as a practice.
Absolutely. And you know, and everybody I think experiences it in their own unique way. I know that my relationship with it, I had a really hard time with Tonglen up front because I was like really into boundaries when I first learned about it. And I was like, hell no, I'm not going to breathe in people's like yucky stuff. I don't want that. Like I'm trying to like get away from that, right? You know? And I think it was because I was confusing it with, again, I, Jen Harkness, had to take that in and transform it. Well, that's not what I believe they're talking about. It's look, the suffering's already there. If somebody's in front of me and they're crying and they are depressed or they're in crisis, right? That's already there. And mm-hmm. so I'm already with it and I'm already witnessing it. What I see it as is I breathe in, I allow that to be there, right? I feel it and I allow it to be there and I let it drop into, you know, we can use the term bodhicitta, but the way I feel it, experience it, conceptualize it is it's that bigger container. It's dropping into the bigger thing of, yeah, there is suffering mm-hmm. and the breath out is, and there is love and beauty and joy and equanimity. For me, in a way, Tonglen is about holding duality. I can be with the suffering and I can also still hold that place of sanity and health and goodness all at the same time. It's about emotional pluralism and it's about the capacity that you cultivate through that practice to be with that duality with someone, with the world, and say, yeah, I get it. I am with your suffering and there is love and there is health in this and there is a way through. It's going to pass, like trust impermanence. And that's also where I can drop into, I don't have to have the answers. I just have to be with. That's, you know, I'm witnessing, and that's through dropping into that, that's where you get the answers. And then if, you know, if I want to geek out on a therapist level, because I love to, right? You know,
dude,
on a nervous system level, let's say Tonglen, take out all the spiritual stuff. it's a regulating activity. Like, it regulates your nervous system to breathe like that. It regulates your nervous system to link up your thinking brain and your limbic brain together and name it. And when you're regulated in your nervous system and in your emotions and your limbic system, you can think clearer. So if nothing else, I am regulating my body and my mind so I can be clear in that moment. So, you know, again, whether you want to buy into the spiritual component, which I do, but even if you don't, having practices like that, right, that involve breath, that involve coming into the moment with your mind and your body, are going to be beneficial and are a huge part of self-care.
Yeah. I mean, that comes back to the marathon thing you're talking about and the little things accumulating over time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been scientifically proven that meditation can help you build new neural pathways. And mm-hmm. it's been scientifically proven by watching the way that your habits have pathways already and why your brain makes those connections so quickly. So it's like, yeah, there is that, there is the spirituality to it, which for me, I think is really important because for me, mm-hmm. I think spirituality is again, connecting to that bigger container of the fullness of a human experience, but it's also like immensely practical and scientifically proven.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The other thing too, and this is very Buddhist, but I think again, the mindfulness movement in psychology is also validating this.
Yeah.
Self-care isn't, it's about dropping those expectations too. If I go in thinking I'm going to help and I'm going to fix it, right? It's probably going to be a setup, not only for me, but the other person, right? And the more that you can just be with what is and build tolerance and capacity to be with discomfort and be with not knowing and ambiguity and all of these things, your tolerance level of distress grows, the better you're going to feel. And like I said, the more clear you're going to be on your answers. And part of that mindfulness too, Kate, is figuring out your triggers. You have to know, you have to know where your triggers are. You have to know, like for instance, when I get stressed, you know what the first thing I do is I just start saying yes to everything. Like I'm one of those, like some people, like when they get stressed, they you know, put on the brakes and they're like, no, but I'm one of those people and I know I'm not alone. So there's going to be some listeners that are going to resound to this. I'll start being like, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. And I overextend myself. So I know that that's one of my coping mechanisms. So I know the first thing I need to do is to say no, right? I have to go the opposite. I have to know what my big triggers are, like illness. Especially childhood illness, such a huge trigger for me. It's almost like unbearable on some levels. Like I really get personally upset about it. Mm-hmm. Now I can sit with childhood trauma and like abuse all day, but childhood illness, so hard. That's where I have to know, you know, I did a rotation at Children's Hospital and I was like, I can't work with this. Right. I have to know my limits. And then go towards where my gifts and capacities are and be okay with the fact that I can't work with everybody. I can't do everything. You need to pick and choose where what's going to be most beneficial for you, right?
Yeah, it's being part of that bigger whole, right? And mm-hmm. understanding like I don't have to do everything because there is someone else who does have the capacity for this.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mm-hmm. have to be me.
Yeah. And it's like that. It's like a Mr. Rogers quote, like, you know, when there's bad things happening, look for the helpers. There's always helpers. There are so many people. It's really easy in this social justice advocacy helping game. Not that it's a game, but, you know, viewpoint, right?
Yeah.
Where we're witnessing the suffering in the world so acutely that we start to feel like that's all there is. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that that's one of the things I hear the most is just people getting flooded and overwhelmed with like, it's all just totally messed up and it's doom, right? Yeah. I mean, undoubtedly, it is a very rich, interesting time to be alive because there's a lot of stuff going on mm-hmm. that's challenging. On the flip side, there is a lot good going on.
Yeah.
You know, there we've got child protective services. You know, that's a pretty new thing in the world, like mm-hmm. historically, that we're even thinking about child welfare. You know, I'm a single woman in my 40s that runs a business. 50, 60 years ago, that's unheard of.
So you think about how long ago, actually, not very long ago, it was that women got the vote.
Right.
And we're talking about a small group of women as well. We're talking about very privileged women who got the vote in the first place.
Right. And so you have to, so one of the things I think we're talking about right now that is critical is you have to work with your negativity bias in your brain for self-care. So like right. We are all wired to focus on the challenge because evolutionarily speaking, right, we had to remember where the black bear was, like it was going to maul us where we picked berries, you know, but we didn't have to remember like the day we had a party. So we all do that. And under stress, we do it more. Mm-hmm. And so when you're actively going in, because activists, we're actively going into the stress. That's mm-hmm. That's what we're doing. We're saying we're going to go into the stress and we're going to try to support. So it's really easy to get skewed that way. So you have to always be looking for the positive. You have to rewire your brain to see where the light is in any situation and build that up, or else you're going to start to over time get skewed and get really pessimistic and cynical and angry and hopeless and overwhelmed. I remember one time I was so burnout. I go through kind of cycles of burnout because I teach this stuff, but of course it slips. And the next thing I know, I'm like, wow, I'm really stressed, you know? And, and years ago, I was really burnout. And I remember a mentor of mine saying, you need to think of like at least one positive thing a day. And I remember right up front, it was like, I drank enough water today. You know, like that was my positive thing because I was so burnt, you know. Over time of doing that, even starting with I took care of myself in this one way, led me to also seeing now somebody can come in and tell me a horrific story and I will hear the terribleness in it for sure, but I'll also hear the resiliency. Yeah. And I'll hear the resourcing and I'll hear the strengths and I'll pull from that because that's ultimately what we need to pull from to help these challenges. We have to pull from the resiliency and the basic goodness of the human spirit in order to address it. And so that's what we got to focus on.
That's brilliant. That is great. I think that's a fantastic spot to stop on.
Perfect.
Very strong. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kate. It was delightful.
Jen Harkness runs workshops on self-care and has presented at various state and national conferences, agencies, and schools. For more detailed information or to connect with Ms. Harkness, visit CourageousHeartHealing.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.